Morning, everybody. We're going to start in 4 minutes.
Hello.
See how that's
well, okay.
See
so,
that?
Oh, there, there,
yeah.
There it is. Okay.
When the mic's not on.
Okay, thanks.
For transcript purposes, this is CCNSO members meeting day 2 on 17th of October. So, good morning, everybody, and welcome to day 2 of the CCNSO members' meeting. We're going to start off bright and early with a discussion on local and community wicket initiatives. And then we have another visitation from the GNSO talking about the locking of a domain name subject to UDRP or dispute proceedings. That takes us to the coffee break at 10:45. Following which we have an update from the NOMCOM and then our ever-popular CCTRD news session and regional organisation news. We break for lunch. I'm afraid we don't have a lunch sponsor for today, so each to his own arrangements or her own arrangements, but come back promptly if you would please for 2, where we have our popular panel discussion on registry principles. We also have a new session after that, which is a Q&A for the candidates who are standing for election in the AP and EU region, which should be good, I hope. We end the day then with the CCNSO Council meeting. So again, we have a very full and varied agenda for day two, and I will endeavour to ensure that we run to time, but also cover all of the aspects of that item list. So over to you, Keith, for session number one.
Thank you. Thank you, Leslie, and good morning, everybody. And this first session this morning is on the topic of the WICIT, the WCIT. And following on from ICANN Prague, we agreed to have this meeting and really as a reporting in session from various ICANN folks who have been stimulated into being engaged in the WICIT process. So before we start, just a point of clarification, I think, yeah, there seems to be a little bit of tension that ICANN is wanting to sort of beat up on the ITU and stand in its way and so on. And I think, you know, our purpose is not to try and encourage people to do that. And you know, there will be a wide range of views from the CCTLD community alone as to whether they support or don't support the ITRs, including internet matters and so on. The issue here is to encourage participation from whatever form or place you're coming from. This is one of those instances where there is a treaty coming out of the other end, and if you don't participate in the process, you shouldn't be surprised with what comes out of the other end. So it is your chance to influence it in whichever form that takes. So I think that's really important to note as well. This is not anti-ITU. This is about finding a treaty that will suit your needs best, or that you need to be involved in the process to assert what you need. So this morning we have a panel of which three members are currently missing, who have not apologised, and two have apologised for non-appearance due to other commitments. But I think rather than introduce everybody, I'll introduce the speakers and hopefully not have to shuffle through the order too much. But our first speaking slots were for Bill Drake from the NCUC of the GNSO, and then Olivier Crepin-Leblond from At Large. Olga Cavalli was going to give us a report from the GAC, but she can't make it at all. So I think, Bill, can we hand over to you? And I think you're going to give us perhaps a little bit more of a background than just purely the GNSO's look at this item, because you've been following it quite closely over the recent years. So, Bill, for up to 10 minutes, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, and good morning, everybody. I'm very happy, after 4 years in the GNSO Council, to be over on the visiting the other side, as long as that's a relevant distinction. I can't say that there's a GNSO view on WICIT. It's not really a matter that's come up in council discussions at all. but there is, of course, a great deal of interest in the internet community more generally. In fact, we did a panel on this at NCUC's policy conference on Friday with Tariq Kamel and others, talking about how people saw the potential impact of WICIT on ICANN's operations, which I thought was rather interesting. And I've been working on these kinds of issues for a long time as an academic. Actually wrote my doctorate 25 years ago on the international telecommunications regime, and have published a great deal since then on the ITU and its regulatory arrangements. So I have the distinct, weird distinction, I guess, of being a ITR junkie, international telecommunications regulations. I have every copy of them going back to 1865 in my office, and I've written about them. So anything you want to know about telegraph rates, just ask me. And we'll be doing quite a lot about this in Baku as well. I'm organizing with ISOC a workshop on this, and we'll be talking about it in the main session on CIR, critical internet resources, and then some preparatory meetings as well. So a lot going on. As we all know, there's been a great deal of hype and hysteria around Wicket, a lot of people saying that, you know, the sky is going to fall, the internet's in its greatest danger ever, and so on and so forth because of this. And that, of course, has then led to a lot of politicians in America jumping on board and using it as an example, as an instance where they could push their own agendas vis-a-vis the United Nations and so on, which has been a little bit unfortunate. The good news about all that mania has been that it mobilized people, got them focused on a process that really otherwise would have been a in-house ITU activity, and one that could have potentially impacted a great deal of players who were not at the table or even aware of what was going on. So that's the good news about the mania. But the bad news, of course, has been that there's been a tendency sometimes to overstate or misstate exactly what the impacts can be, which, of course, for one thing, allows the ITU and its and the governments that favor some of the more regulatory types of approaches to snap back and say, well, you know, you don't understand, you're engaging in myth-making, this is not true, you're mischaracterizing the whole effort, etc. So that's the downside. There's also been skeptics who have reacted to all this and said, well, you know, it's no big deal, really. The UN's not going to take over the internet, and all the bad actions in the internet take place at the national level anyway, so what do we care about the ITU? And anyway, people can, governments that don't like some of the proposals can always issue reservations, and that's true. It's a standard practice going back 100 and something years for governments to issue quite elaborate reservations on the international telecommunications regulations and its predecessors, and these can be quite sweeping. I mean, for example, the 1988 regulations, the U.S. government reserved its right to make any additional reservations at any time and reserves its rights to take any action it deems necessary at any time to protect its interests. Well, that pretty much means, you know, we'll follow this as long as it's compatible with what we want, and we won't when it isn't. So, but the problem is, it's not so simple. The fact that governments can take reservations on bad proposals doesn't mean that the bad proposals can't have any bad impacts, because what can happen, of course, is that some governments will choose to fully implement and stick to those bad proposals, both in their domestic environments, where they will say to companies or users and so on, well, gee, I'd like to allow you to do X, Y, Z, but I'm party to an international treaty that tells me that it's no good, you can't do it. And similarly, they will also perhaps argue to bilateral correspondents, countries with whom they have telecommunications linkages, that these linkages must be subject to the same provisions. So you could get, then, a certain amount of fragmentation in the internet overall. If you get patches of the internet where, say, in Russia and the CIS countries, they were pursuing a different approach towards routing that was more restrictive and more interventionist in terms of security, etc., then that could impact the way, you know, traffic has to move around the world and how everybody would have to adjust to things. So it could raise costs. It could lead to technical problems. It's not a negligible issue. Moreover, some of the proposals go quite far beyond what you might expect in terms of their scope, in ways that really could open up a lot of further political moves to try to territorialize and apply national sovereignty and monopoly control again from the telecom environment into the internet environment in ways that could also further fragmentation. So there is a risk of a sort of cyber neo-medievalism here, where you get very fragmented patterns of authority and conditions, operating conditions around the internet globally, and that wouldn't be a good thing. So there's every reason for people to be concerned about these things and to stay engaged. And quite frankly, you know, the story won't end with Wicket either, because what's really interesting, of course, is what's behind the proposals. There are a lot of governments that will continue in the years ahead to press for more regulatory, more restrictive approaches to certain aspects of the internet, and this will come up again in multiple other international forums. So irrespective of what finally happens at the Wicket, these issues won't go away. We have a sizable number of governments that do wish to have a more regulatory, more top-down approach to the management of the internet at a global level, and they will continue to push for that in various forms. I don't really have time to go through all the history of the international telecommunications regulations as much as I love to. It's one of my great passions. I know Chloe would really like that conversation, but I'm not going to do that. I will tell you, though, that there has been a very elaborate process for preparing for this conference. It's been going on, really, since 1999, because, frankly, a lot of governments and their national telecommunications administrations who have lost out in the process of liberalization and privatization, as they see it, have been pushing for a long time for revision of the telecom regulations to strengthen them in light of the new environment, and that has generally involved a lot of, and the Internet is central to that environment, thinking. So if you look at the whole tortured history of the proposals that have been involved through the ITU preparatory process and, importantly, through the regional coordination process, which is very important in UN contexts, you will see that there's been quite a strong trajectory. I mean, there have been times when people were putting almost anything into the pot. You know, it became like a Christmas tree, I'm mixing my metaphors, where anybody could hang anything that they wanted onto. There's a core set of concerns that have to do with telecommunications and money and the organization of the global market, but then there's some ancillary concerns that people have used the opportunity to toss into the pot. There were times when there were proposals for the ITU to become a global registry for IPv6 numbers. There were times when there were proposals that would impact directly ICANN's management of names and numbers. Most of those things have gone to the wayside, and we're really back to the boundary lines between telecommunications and the Internet and whether or not telecom-style regulations should apply to the Internet, particularly with regard to the global organization of traffic. So let me just quickly mention a few of the potential issues here. One is, who is to be covered by the international telecommunications regulations? Proposals that have a lot of support from many developing countries, Russia, China, and others, are to say essentially that all companies involved in providing any kind of international communication service should be subject to the regulations. They want to take out this critical term, recognized operating agency, and just say any operating agency that's involved in somehow in global communications would be subject to the regulations. This would have a very sweeping impact. It would mean that all the ISPs in the world and potentially even so-called over-the-top providers of services could be subject to the regulations. What is to be covered? Well, some have proposed essentially to alter the definition of telecommunications to include and information processing, which basically means that the Internet becomes telecommunications, subject to the, and then everything in the regulations would apply to the Internet. There are proposals to add telecommunications and ICT to expand the ITU's jurisdiction to all information communication technology through this agreement. There are proposals to standardize new terms like international Internet traffic termination services. This is like, I guess, when a YouTube call is finished. This is telecom think applied to the Internet. So when you hang up your computer, you know, your call is subject. In any event, then there's a lot of proposals that have to do with things like spam, online fraud, number abuse. That's an important one for many developing countries in the telephone environment. And again, depending on how you define the Internet in relation to telecom, that could apply to numbers that we work with. So number abuse, privacy, child protection, emergency telecom services, security. There's a lot of proposals on security. Russia wants limitations on the use of information warfare, mutual obligations to avoid anything bad coming across national frontiers, so you can all closely police those teenagers in the garage that are releasing code out into the wild. China wanted to have a proposal where states are all given the responsibility to supervise all entities using ICT in their territories to ensure security and trustworthy conditions. They forgot to say harmony, but I guess, you know, that's in there too. There are proposals to make technical standards mandatory rather than voluntary, as they've always been, to make the ITU a dispute resolution body for issues pertaining potentially to the Internet as well, depending, again, on the definitional questions, and so on. So and the hottest topics, of course, though, have to do with the money. And this is in particular proposals around routing, And being able to identify where everything comes from in order to ensure proper charging, etc. Of course, in the internet environment, being able to identify where everything comes from becomes a little bit different task. And there have been proposals, of course, having to do with trying to reinvigorate the old accounting rate system that was used to settle accounts in international telecommunications, which now only covers about 2% of global traffic. And some people are saying, well, let's reboot that. And finally, there's been this proposal, I'm sure everybody's heard about it, from the European telecommunications network operators that would essentially try to seek regulatory relief from European regulation through a multilateral treaty. They don't want to be locked into any net neutrality types of requirements and so on. And so they're proposing that the international treaty should officially bless quality of service in the internet. And they're not kidding. They say, you know, this is about the internet. Quality of service and also sender pays, settlement systems. They want to establish a framework for the negotiation of commercial contracts that would be subject to an international regulatory treaty. So these are quite serious proposals, and those have been picked up in particular by the Arab countries and a number of the African countries that have serious financial concerns about what's going on in the global communications environment. So all of these issues are serious. They can't be wished away. It's not the end of the world, but there could be some bad outcomes if language is included in the process of negotiation, and, you know, these negotiations will go down to the 11th hour and will result in compromises and so forth. If there's any words left in there, any us instead of thus, that somebody could interpret as giving them a mandate to apply these regulations into the internet space in some way, then you could have some countries seeking to do that. So it's important to remain engaged and be mindful of these things. And I'm glad that, if nothing else, the amount of hype around this issue has at least gotten people to focus on it globally. We're going to be exploring these things in Baku at the IGF in some detail, and I hope people will come to those events and we'll have a chance for a real open multi-stakeholder dialogue around this. So that's that. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Bill. And that sets the stage nicely for this morning. Can I just ask one question to bring this back to ICANN and the GNSO? In talking to your colleagues in the GNSO, I assume there are a number who will be engaging through industry groups in the WICCET process as well. Would that be fair to say?
There are a few people from the GNSO community who I know will be on the U.S. Delegation, as am I, but I can't say that I've detected a great deal of interest across the board in the GNSO community, and certainly in the Council we have never discussed anything related to this.
Okay, thank you. Just yesterday in the CCNSO meeting with the ICANN board, the topic of WICCET came up and we were seeking the ICANN board's elaboration of their strategy for WICCET engagement. And one of the topics that came up was that perhaps ICANN might open a mailing list for people who are attending so that we can remain in contact with each other during the meeting to cover off on drafting sessions and so on and so on. So if you could just pass that on to anyone who you know is attending. I think ICANN will let us know in due course what the greater details are, but something's happening. Anyway, thank you very much, Bill. And we'll hold back questions until after we've heard from at large, and then we'll go to question time. And that way, if either Bill or Olivier need to dash off to other commitments, we can let them go and then carry on with the CCTLD world. So our next speaker on the panel this morning is Olivier Crepin de Blon, who is the at-large chair. And please, Olivier, could you give us 5 minutes of update on at-large's involvement in WICCET? Thank you.
Absolutely, Keith. Thank you very much. I'm Olivier Crepin de Blon. for the transcript record. Just two things. I'm sorry to have arrived a bit late. I've sampled one of the many times running between one end of the conference center to the other, and it's raining outside, so that just adds a little more fun. I'm also glad, one of the only sessions I'm actually glad there is no interpretation, because the speed at which my friend Bill here went through his part was quite incredible. Down to at large, we basically, as you all know, are pretty much interested in the internet user's point of view, and the WCIT ITRs are set to really impact on internet users. I gather the information content providers are also going to be equally as impacted, since the charging is being proposed as being changed, and Bill has very, very kindly gone through the whole list of things. We've actually had three things that we've done. The first one was a WCIT webinar, so as to explain to our members what the issues were, and Nigel Hickson has very kindly held that seminar, and we had a very good attendance on that. We definitely have many of our users, many of our at-large structures interested in the subject, specifically because one of the, I wouldn't say a task, but one of the suggestions that we have made to many of our at-large structures is to try and find if they could act locally. Acting locally with a government, because ultimately the WCIT will be a meeting of governments, and several of them do entertain very good links with their governments. Several have gotten involved at local level when there was a multi-stakeholder process put together by the government in order to get a test, feel the temperature of what the country felt like. Of course, in some cases, governments did not indulge in any multi-stakeholder processes. They just made their positions, did this behind closed doors. But in some other cases, some governments have held both meetings, face-to-face meetings. The British government, for example, has done that. I know the U.S. has created a mailing list with much traffic and discussion going on in this. And so as a first step forward, several of our at-large structures have taken part in those discussions in their respective countries. And we hope that their input into the process has somehow swayed the direction in which their country will decide to go. Obviously we're all for the multi-stakeholder process, so effectively sway the country away from being aligned with some of the propositions that China are bringing forward, and the Arabic countries, etc. At the same time, some have actually gone even further and have managed to shape the response from their country simply because their governments were not particularly well knowledgeable about the issues. And so they've, through education of their officials, they've been able to really decide on which direction the country would go. Several IGFs taking place locally have had some of our members take part. And I know for a fact that at least two or three, one of which I've actually attended, have actually decided to change their opinions and decide to go towards the free internet that we know today, rather than establishing more control over the internet. Now, in addition to this, in some cases, we've even managed to have some of our members go on to the delegations that will be going over to Dubai. So that really is an ongoing process. I think the worth of having so many members that speak to each other is first one of coordination. Several will be speaking to each other and probably act as a bridge between the delegations. That's just one hope. Of course, we can only speculate at this point in time. But in order to also help with this, we have a wiki page which has been set up, which actually provides links to all of the resources, maybe not all because they're hundreds of resources out there, but most or many of the resources, let's bring this down one level, many of the resources that are WCIT related, both on the ITU website, but also the other websites out there that deal with such information. Several of our members are Internet Society chapters, so they also have a process in the Internet Society to share information, and as you all know, the Internet Society has been a very strong defender of the Internet. Effectively, they've actually been able to provide a lot of input in being able to share this with other members of our community. Apart from this, obviously, we're all looking forward to see things move forward. There is a concern that we might be focusing a lot on what's going to go on in Dubai, but this is not the end of the process. There is going to be something after Dubai. We're all aware of that. And one of the threads has been to think, well, what happens next after Dubai, and to prepare this. So really, it's not a short-term effort to look at things and say, in December, that's it, our job is finished. It really is an ongoing effort that will continue way after Dubai. And aside from being able to coordinate between the different at-large structures that we have, there isn't very that much more that we can do. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Olivier. And it sounds like there's been some real effort going in and at large. Well done. I'll now open up the floor for questions for Bill and Olivier specifically. So are there any questions?
No. It's not so much a question, but I
Could
wondered.
You please identify
I will
yourself.
Identify myself indeed for the transcript record. It's Cheryl Langdon Orr. I wondered if it might be of some use, Keith, for the URL of that resource wiki page to be part of the meeting notes from this gathering. That's all.
Thank you. Good thinking, Cheryl, and we'll note that and pass it round to the CCTLD list. Thank you. Any other questions? Any other observations? Any other feelings about other than CCTLD world? Any other feelings about ICANN's involvement?
The question is for Bill. I'm just curious, having you have
for the record, could you identify yourself?
Sure. My
Mr.
name is
Meeking Host.
My name is Byron Holland from .ca. And Bill, I'm just curious, in all the research that you've done, what are the top few issues that you really think the CC community directly should be most paying attention to or most concerned about? Because you've certainly given a broad range of issues, but what, in your opinion, would be most concerning to this community?
Well, Byron, that's a very interesting question, because when Keith asked me to do this, my first thought was, really, the CCs are interested in this? And I wondered, well, is there a distinctive agenda that would be more specific to the CC world than just the internet environment generally? And I can't tell you that I'm deep enough inside your considerations to be able to identify what those distinctive issues might be. The big proposals, the ones that have potential traction that could cause some concern, pertaining to, for example, the economic organization of traffic flows, depending again if people start to interpret telecommunications to encompass the internet and therefore argue that telecommunications policies pertaining to number abuse and fraud and so on also apply to the internet environment, particularly given that most public switch telephone networks are moving towards IP core networks anyway. I mean, these convergence issues are interesting. You could get, obviously, some circumstances where this would impact the way traffic moves around and the way all number use, resources are being used and addresses and so on. So, but it's an abstraction at this point. You know, if you look at all the different proposals, yeah, I mean, if you understand the way the ITU process works, you got a lot of countries just doing wish listy kinds of things. Whatever problems they're encountering in their markets, you know, they come up with a proposal that would address it, and so they toss it in there. It doesn't necessarily mean that they think that it's going to actually end up in the final agreement. So you could focus on individual proposals and think, wow, depending on what happens with this other one, this could really mean X and Y and Z. But there's no way to really gauge what the prospects of that staying in are going to be. You know what I mean? So it makes having a, you know, it's very hard to tell right now what the scenarios will be in terms of what language will remain in there and what not won't, and therefore what might be most problematic. But with regard to it being specific to CCTLDs as opposed to TLDs generally, nothing is straight. I don't know that I can get my head around that right now. I was hoping you guys were going to explain to me precisely what you thought those connections were. Maybe somebody else here can do that.
We might come back to that question at the end of the session. Thanks. Olivier.
Thank you, Keith. Two things, I think. The first one being the change in the charging model of the Internet, which might have one consequence, which is effectively the breaking up of the universality of the network. And therefore having two internets or more, there's a breaking up of the whole net as such into those countries that will charge one way and those that will charge in another way, and traffic not being able to go across everywhere. That's one big concern. The other one is the setting of a precedent that changes a multi-stakeholder model of governance into a multilateral model of governance, and that's a concern as well. And just to add to my previous intervention, I've put the WCIT at large page onto the chat for this room.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Adam.
Hi. Good morning. Adam Peak. Just to note that Hamadan Touré said very specifically that the narrower internet governance issues will not be part of the wicket. And as the Secretariat, he can say that. Whether a member state can still bring up issues that are narrow internet governance being ICANN-related, CCTLD-related, and IP address-related. They've been quite specific, saying that those will not be part of WICKET. But that's the Secretariat saying that. A member state can still introduce anything they want. But at this time, I don't think there is anything that is very specific within the WICKET documents that relate to CCTLDs, other than the fact that anything that impacts on the internet and the ITU's involvement in the internet may find that you will find that the ITU becomes a greater authority for internet-related policy issues. Therefore, CCTLDs would be spending more time and energy in ITU environments. But at the moment, if we believe him, and we should do, because he's a nice man, then no, there won't be internet governance issues in WICKET.
Thank you, Adam. I think that was more an observation than a question, but is there a response? No. Okay. Back to Byron.
Well, I think maybe the devil's in the details around the term narrow internet governance issues. For those of us, and not everybody does, but for those of us who actually operate all our own DNS infrastructure, I'm trying to get my head around how might that be impacted if you find yourself subject to a quality of service regime. Right, that's not a narrow internet governance issue, but how might that affect us? So I think that would definitely be one issue that, while not a narrow internet governance issue, could potentially have a dramatic impact on us, I think, but I really don't know and don't understand yet. And I think also security-related issues. I mean, we in this room have access to an unbelievable amount of DNS data, and if national governments got interested in that and were subject to some kind of secure new security arrangement, those of us who direct the traffic and have the data may find ourselves suddenly in a very different world and environment. Maybe. I don't know. So that's really my question. How might we be impacted at that level if QoS or security goes a certain way?
I guess the point I was trying to make is the potential impacts are, to, as far as I can see, generic across the Internet and not specific to the CCs. So that's not to say CCs shouldn't be concerned, but rather that CCs should be concerned along with everybody else in the Internet environment, if I wasn't clear about that. So I'm not dismissing that there's any, you know, reason for you to be concerned. I'm only saying I don't know that there's nothing targeting CCs per se in the language. Now, let's take a hypothetical. Let's say that they keep in the provisions a proposal to make sure that all traffic routing is identifiable to the incoming operator, okay? That because they're very, for example, when you talk to people from developing country delegations often in around ITU, they'll say, look, we got a lot of this kind of funny stuff where traffic is being spun around the world through hubs and least cost connections, et cetera, in ways that deprive us of some income. If the traffic was being routed in the traditional bilateral way that we were used to between two major national carriers subject to the accounting and settlement system, we got a big chunk of change. But now the traffic is being spun around the world through hubs and all these other kinds of techniques that reduces the income that comes into us. So we'd like to know where all the traffic comes from. So we want to put that into the agreement, and we think that that applies not only to voice telephony, but, you know, communications generally. So what would that mean is for an infrastructure operator like yourself, if all traffic has to be, the movement, the patterns of traffic, the sources of it, et cetera, all has to be identifiable to a recipient national carrier. I would presume that this would add, trying to accommodate that request would add quite a great deal of complexity to your operations given the way the Internet works. So, I mean, that's something where then, you know, I don't know how you would deal with that. If for example, traffic is going to, let's say, Russia or a Middle Eastern country that says, well, that's how we interpret this. It's coming from Canada in some way as far as they're concerned, and they want you to provide a full transparency to them about exactly where the bits move across the network and who's making money off of handing it across each link, etc., in the peering arrangements until it gets to them. I don't know how you would deal with that. but it sounds complicated, doesn't it? And it sounds like a potential source of problems in commercial negotiations and perhaps intergovernmentally. So again, all of these things could, you know, if, again, there's the fundamental question of whether the boundary line between telecom and Internet gets blurred, then all bets are off in terms of how all these provisions could be interpreted. The financial ones, the routing ones, what is fraud? I mean, you know, if suddenly you have a multilateral agreement on fraud that covers, by extension, fraud on the Internet, woo. We're in fun times because there's quite a bit of fraud. These are concerns. So the core definitional ones and are really a problem. And I have to say, when we were at the Asia Pacific Internet Governance Conference in July in Tokyo, I was on a panel with a gentleman from the senior person from the Japanese government who said I almost fell off the table. He said, well, as far as we're concerned, the existing definition of telecommunications under the ITU already covers the Internet. And I went, oh, really? And I pressed him for clarification on that. And he said, yeah, I don't see why not. It's signals. It's, you know, so we tried to talk about, you know, computer two and how in the U.S. Historically the internet was viewed as an application and then it's not the underlying transmission, et cetera. But they were saying, well, you know, it's all in a digital IP-based network. You know, these are not useful distinctions anymore. So I think a lot of governments are struggling with exactly what are the boundary lines between traditional telecommunications regulations and obligations, you know, for quality of service, for safety of service, you know, all those kinds of things. And the net, in the U.S., the Federal Communications Commission has had to try to think about those things too. And I'm sure in Canada and elsewhere, you know, do you have 911 type calling and other things over the internet? What obligations should apply? We will continue to struggle with this boundary line question. And as long as that's the case, then you're going to have variable efforts in different environments to say that the kinds of provisions that one would normally associate with telecom need to apply to the internet as well. And you're going to have to cope with that.
Thanks, Bill. And that reminds me that session at the Asia-Pacific Regional IGF was a very interesting discussion, and I believe that's online, so you can probably track it through aprigf.org or aprigf.asia. So if you're interested in having a look at that panel discussion, I'm sure you'll find the link from there. I think we have a question from Jay, and that will have to be the end of questions. So, Jay.
Thank you. This is Jay Daly from .nz, and I'm quite happy with a short and focused answer to this question. Let's imagine that the ITRs, new ITRs and all of the proposals from all of the countries with slightly different view on multi-stakeholder governance from us are all approved. How much of a difference will that actually make? Who will actually take any notice of it?
Oh, sorry, we didn't quite hear the question. You may be hearing the microphone better at that end of the room, but we're really struggling to hear.
Okay, Keith, I'll try again. Just to start by saying I'm quite happy with a relatively short and focused answer to this question. Let's imagine that the ITRs that are being proposed by countries with a less enlightened view of multi-stakeholder governance to us and the internet are actually all approved. How much effective difference will that make? Who will actually take any notice of it, and will it matter to us?
So I assume you're suggesting that enlightened countries may be able to ignore the treaty that comes out. Olivier would like to respond.
Yeah, thank you, Keith. The ITRs, if they get all approved, do have to be ratified into national law by the different member administrations. So some might not. And then it's a big question mark, isn't it? Because what happens when the ITRs are implemented by some countries and are not by other countries? And this is where it comes back to the risk that I mentioned earlier, the breakup of the internet into two different types of internet, and there is no real understanding of how the two would work together.
Thanks, Olivier. Martin.
Martin Boyle from Romanet. I think the really big difference that will happen is that it will move the forum in which you discuss the policies and the standards and the processes away from an arrangement that is essentially built on a multi-stakeholder pattern into one that certainly at the moment is very heavily dominated by the telcos, by the people who provide the normal telecommunications services, and one in which it is, generally speaking, very difficult for smaller organisations and for internet organisations to develop their position and their influence in that discussion. So I think the short answer to your question, Jay, is that it will make it very much more difficult for the whole of the small definition internet governance organizations to shape the environment in which we work. Thank you.
Thanks, Martin. I think, can we now give our thanks to Bill and Olivier for their time, and just in case either of them have to run and in the meantime. So please join me in thanking both Bill and Olivier. We'll now move on to the aspects of the CCTLDs and what CCTLDs have been doing and where they're at. But before we go to that in detail, Alan McGilvray from .ca has a presentation for us, the 8 things to remember about WCIT. So, Alan, 5 minutes, the floor is yours.
Yeah, you have our clever 8 things there.
I wish I knew how to drive that technology.
Well, soon there will be my list of 8 things to on there. But so firstly, very quickly, because Keith, and thanks very much, is holding me to 5 minutes, so I'll try and be quick. And this is actually going to repeat a lot of what's been said already. This always happens, but that's fine. Number one is the WCIT is about telecommunications. It's not about the internet only. And for example, there are going to be other issues that have nothing to do with the internet community. I think the largest is probably mobile roaming. I think anyone who travels internationally knows what a problem that is, and it's a problem in the world, and it's one of the issues they're going to try and tackle in Dubai. So it isn't all about the internet. I think the most important, if I can make 1 or 2 important points today, one is this is a government meeting. Okay, it's only going to be government people talking to themselves. So this is an important point to understand, and I think we'll talk a little about some of us joining our national government delegations. I think ISOC and others are going as sector members. But at the end of the day, governments are going to be taking the decisions, government officials for the most part, but there will be some elected officials as well. So I guess what's part of this as well, only government proposals can be put on the table. So, for example, the Aetna proposal, which has been around, Aetna has no authority in its own right to put a proposal on the table. It would have to be one of the member countries from the EU, from Europe, who would actually put that on. And from what I hear, I don't think that's going to happen. Actually, the third point is, there I am. There's been a lot of debate about the transparency of the process, and the ITU has published the so-called temporary document 64, TD64, in the summer, which was the result of a very long preparatory process. And while there's a lot of valuable insight in that document as to the nature of the proposals that could come forward, TD64 is not itself a proposal anymore. It's just now a background document. Even though some of those proposals are now coming forward again in the proposals from both some of the regions like APT and CTEL that are part of the process, as well as the member countries. Thirdly, as Adam said, internet governance is not the subject of any specific proposal that has been made to this point, including in TD64. I heard a story about someone from a very large Western country commenting on the fact that since internet governance has not been mentioned in any of the documents, what's this big concern about everything, right? But actually, it's all in the detail of the implications of some of the proposals for changing in IP addresses, on security, et cetera, which, if those were implemented, would in fact give the ITU a role in that, and that would and therefore take away some authority from ICANN. Where am I in my list? Actually, the implications of what some of these other proposals have been made are huge. We've already talked to them in a lot. Bill has talked about that. Actually, ISOC has done a lot of very good work on that. I've read, and a lot of what I've learned is from that. And so even such proposals as making standards mandatory, which is the approach the ITU takes in the T sector. In the internet world, standards are not mandatory. They are in the ITU world. So obviously we talked about the interconnection model that sending party pays. That would have a huge impact on the internet, which has nothing to do with internet governance. It would just completely change the flow of money in the world. The Aetna proposal is about money. It's not about a power grab within the ITU. So what's next here? Oh, process. So they can't really think that they can do a revised treaty in 2 weeks. That's completely unrealistic. It's actually 12 days. I've personally been involved in trade negotiations over the years. They go on for years, and we argue about little words that go on for years and years. Actually, I did a little research. The Law of the Sea Treaty took 9 years to negotiate, from 73 to 82. So I don't think anyone should feel they should be panicked into something because the ITU has decided they want a decision by the 14th of December. So what's the hurry? And I think as someone's already said, in fact, it isn't going to be over in December. So next year we have the World Telecom Policy Forum in May. We have WSIS Plus 10, and we have the plenipotentiary, the ITU's plenipot in 2014, which I think is going to be the main event in this title fight series that we're in. So I think this is just the preliminaries, and so. The final message is coming back to what we were talking about before. This is a government meeting. There's a lot of concern. A lot of what I hear is actually what we would call preaching to the choir. I think a lot of us would probably share the same view on some of these issues in this room, but we shouldn't be talking to each other. We should be talking to our governments. So I really suggest that you go back, that you inform yourselves on these issues, go back. Actually, we can give you the URL so you know who in your home government is the contact person in the ITU, and that's how you can input into your process. Actually, I committed in Prague to doing a little bit of a briefing that might help you start that process, and I've done a draft of that, and maybe we'll tweak that after our sessions this week and get it out to you. So that's it.
Okay, and after tweaking, sending it out to the CCNSO members list and... that might be quite a useful resource document to lots of people. Okay, thank you, Alan. A question before we move on. .ca is engaged with the Canadian government delegation?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, Canada is running a preparatory process domestically for that. Both Byron and I are participating in that and giving our input. Actually, I've seen the draft of our proposal, and we'll go back. Actually, we have a meeting on Monday to talk to them about that, and so we'll do that. And we actually plan to go to Dubai as part of the Canadian government delegation.
Lovely. Thank you. Now we'll move on to Martin Boyle and from .UK. And Martin, 5 minutes on an update of UK government their delegation and the role Nominate will play in that. 5 minutes. Thanks, Martin.
Okay, thank you, Keith. And it's useful to keep those 8 things to remember about Wicket up in front of us, just to remind us of the sort of shape in which this discussion is going. I do have a slight issue with the revised treaty in 2 weeks is unrealistic. I think the pressures within intergovernmental organisations do mean that whatever you do, you are going to end up with a treaty. And that is one of the dangers I think we have got in this process, that there will be enormous pressure for compromise, and the wording of that compromise will be very difficult. I pick up on that because it's very much at the bottom of my mind in Nominate's engagement with the UK government, because what we're looking at trying to do is make sure that our government representation is well informed about what is happening, what the issues are, and what the impacts that we've heard from previous speakers might be on the way that the internet develops, and in particular, the way in which future policy starts being discussed. We actually started discussing with the UK government about well, a bit over a year ago, not with a great deal of success. We managed to get a UK coordination up and running early this year. And a lot of that was a denial mentality that was running through this process, that because internet governance was not named as one of the things in the treaty, that therefore this was not about the internet and it was not about internet governance, in spite of the fact that an awful lot of the proposals on the table covered issues that underpin the way in which the internet works. And so that became really a priority, trying to make sure that our government representation understood the issues that are associated with the internet-related proposals that were on the table. And I will do a shameless plug for ISOC and the analysis work that they have done as being an excellent source for helping us identify and talk through the issues with our government. We've had four coordination meetings so far, and a lot of the work in that has been to help shape the UK's input into the CEPT, the European Regional input into the treaty, and we've got a CPT position that I think, generally speaking, is quite a good one. High-level strategic and policy issues concerning international telecommunications services and facilities, consistency with the definitions of the ITU's role, and such things. And in particular, through the negotiations, the great push that there is to move us beyond ITU looking after telecommunications, which it does in a particular environment of the telecommunications industry, into the wider internet through the definition of ICTs. We've now had announced the UK delegation to WICCIT, and that will include from familiar faces in the ICANN community, Tony Holmes, who is in the GNSO community. Olivier is also on the UK delegation, as is Desiree Milosevic from Filius. And I am also on the UK delegation. And our expectation is that in WICCIT, in the discussions will break down into small drafting groups, and the UK has taken the philosophy that it wants to make sure that it can get into all relevant drafting groups so that we can influence the way the discussion is going. So I'm very, very pleased with the way the UK government has picked up on that. If I can just use the last 30 seconds or so I have for my time to pick up on something the discussion with the board said yesterday, and that has been echoed here today, that this is the first of a series of discussions over the next few years. This autumn, the United Nations General Assembly will consider a whole string of World Summit on the Information Society reviews, and that includes the wonderful words of enhanced cooperation, which essentially is How do you oversee the international internet management process? And it will also look at the reform of the Internet Governance Forum. And my guess is that the pressure will be on trying to get a phase three of WSIS, phase three of the World Summit, perhaps sometime in starting 2015. I hope I'm just being my normal happy pessimistic self, but I fear that I'm not. And as Alan also indicated, we have the World Telecoms Policy Forum. Actually, it's the World Telecoms / ICT Policy Forum. And that is massively wide-ranging, but what is coming out there is a very strong focus on the role of role of ICANN, the role of ISOC, the roles of the regional internet registries. And an awful lot of the discussion is a discussion that fails to understand the way that the internet works. It's got an informal experts group. The documents are appearing on the website for the WTPF. And involved in the discussions are VeriSign, the London Internet Exchange, ISOC, the NRO, ICANN, and we. I'm turning up on behalf of Nominet as sector members. The discussion, again, is going to start looking at things like the Internet Exchange Points and IPv6 and multi-stakeholder model. And looking at my neighbour, looking at her watch, I realise that I'm probably gone beyond my time, so I'll cede the floor. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Martin. And now we have some rapid-fire updates from three CCTLDs. So firstly, Lisa Furr from .dk. In 3 minutes, can you let us know what .dk is doing?
Well, thank you very much and good morning, everyone. I'm Lisa Fuhr from .dk. I'm the COO. In Denmark, we're really struggling to get an overview of Wicket and of all the papers. So what we're doing, we're trying to read as many position papers as possible. But we're also discussing Wicket with our member organizations. DIFO is an association, and we have member organizations that are large telco companies, and those guys do know a lot of ITU and the work there, so we have a lot of bilateral discussions with them. We also arranged to meet with our regulator, the Danish Business Authority, and to exchange views on issues concerning that we're concerned about. So we'll have that in November. And we have arranged a conference called the Internet Day. It's not only about Wicket, but we have a panel discussion on internet governance. But that's with Martin Boyle, and it's with Nigel Hickson from ICANN. And the director of the Danish Business Authority for the international part, Jørgen Abel Andersen, is going to be there, and he's going to be the part of the Danish Wicket delegation. So we're hoping to get a good discussion, and we're really hoping to reach out and get the internet community to respond on if they see Wicket as anything that they should be concerned about or not, because what we find it is that it's a very difficult issue to get through to the community. So I hope this Internet Day will help. And I'm looking at Martin and say, you need to help us. Actually, this session will be moderated by a professor who's very much into internet governance. I hear that everyone says it's not about internet governance, the Wicket, but I think it's a change in a way of thinking if we get internet included in this treaty. So that's one of our worries. But we have a very good communication with our government, because anyway, we have to meet them a lot this fall because they're changing the Domain Name Act in Denmark. So we're using these meetings to get updated all the time on their views.
Thank you, Lisa. Now we move to Polis Nyarenda from .mw. Welcome in 3 minutes. The floor is yours, Polis.
Thank you, Keith. I'm going to talk briefly about what we're doing, and especially what we are doing in our region, the Africa region, which is consisted of quite a number of small CCTLDs, which are not really active in consultations with the wicked as such, but are active in a regional setting. We, of course, realize, just as on the eight things, that WICKED is a government process, and the authoritative entities are governments. So nothing that I will talk about is from an authoritative point of view, because I'm not on a government platform. In the Africa region, the WICKED preparatory process is largely being coordinated by the Africa Telecommunications Union, and in 2011 and 2012, there have been three preparatory meetings, one in Cairo in November 2011, one in Durban in May this year, 2012, and the most recent one in Accra, Ghana, in September. And in these, the ATU has 40 members out of the roughly 50 African countries, so it has a relatively wide mandate to coordinate the activities. As has already been mentioned, there have been quite a few proposals on WICKED from the Africa region, and these have attracted a wide-ranging discussions, and some of the papers are available, such as those on the ITU website. Proposals, for example, have come from countries like Egypt, Rwanda, and Cote d'Ivoire, which there is some participation from the CCs, but the CCs are really small in these countries. The position of each country continues to evolve, and there is no real defined Africa common position. But the ATU has established a mailing contact point where countries are putting in their input in the process. All the issues through the consultation process that have arisen as important to the region and to governments in the region are definitions in the ATRs, the scope of the ATRs, issues on connectivity, costing, accounting, quality of service, the charging, economic and policy issues, standards development, routing, as already mentioned, and dispute resolution. So Africa is highly engaged in the revision of the ITRs, and the CCs are participating not as individuals, but as part of a regional process. Thank you.
Thank you, Polis. And that sounds like substantial interest and input from Africa. And last, but by no means least, Young M. Lee from .ka. Young M., 3 minutes.
Yes, Keith, I see you becoming kind of nervous looking at your watch. So I'm actually timing myself. I first need to kind of explain the background or the current status of KISA. KISA actually has become a government-controlled organization since 2007 when the Internet Address Law was instituted. But the current status of KISA is that it is actually being controlled by the government, but actually has found a way of promoting the multi-stakeholder model of internet governance. There are several tracks for the non-governmental group involvement, cooperating with KISA and KCC, with the Korea Communications Commission, the ministry-level branch responsible for the communication and technology policies. There is the KIGF, not directly related with the IGF, but IGF-like organization in which KCC is actually involved in. And there is the Internet Infrastructure Committee, initiated by mostly by the civil society. And then there is the Internet Address Policy Review Council, which is part of the governmental branch to review the policies. Now, the KISA's position so far has been is that it has been strategically dealing with internet governance, and it has been trying to promote the multi-stakeholder model. However, stronger governmental involvement by other states is not desirable. And ICAO's multi-stakeholder model, while it has its deficiencies, we all know that, is still the better of the evil. So, so the KCC is the primary branch responsible for internet and information technology-related policies. However, because WCID was a UN and ITU initiated issue, the department responsible for internet policies that cooperate with KISA was not consulted initially. There was another branch dealing with that. That department actually didn't know what was going on, so it consulted another civilian organization called TTA, the Telecommunications Technology Association, and that's the organization responsible for setting various standards in telecommunication and information technologies. However, because there were several tracks for civilian or non-governmental involvement, eventually the TTA and the IGF-like body got together to discuss Korea's stand on WCID. And so far, we have decided that there is no need to actively support the proposition of ITU and WCID, but there is no need to currently to actively oppose it. And so we're still trying to make sense of WCID and also the WTPF in 2013. So far, there was one meeting within KIGF of Korea with TTA. We're planning to continue to meet and to discuss this issue, not just WCID, but also WTPF and whatever comes after. And so we are aware of the work of ICANN and the way internet governance has been working within ICANN, and we will continue to cooperate. Thank you.
Thank you, Youngim. It sounds like at least the confusion has been resolved, and it's now a question of finding a way forward. Okay, well, that's it from our presentations, and we have a few minutes to spare. So questions, are there any questions to any of the panelists? Any oh, right down the back.
Paul Schindler from .au. Apologies for the confusion. I was on the panel, off the panel. I thought we were a little crowded for time. Is that better, Keith?
That's a little bit better. But
a little? I can hear myself. It's unnerving.
It must be louder at that end of the room than this end. Can we? Can our sound people do some adjusting? Because we're really struggling to hear people in the microphones.
Hopefully this is better. All I wanted to say was a minor, I think it's an issue about a call to arms, because the reason why I didn't particularly feel like I had value to add or something to say on this panel is because we've been very fortunate in Australia, where the Australian government has been incredibly open and consultative on its position for WCID. To be honest, that took a little bit of prodding from us and APNIC and others to start with, because we got to the game first, before they were really formulating their thoughts. But every draft regional position has been shared and discussed with stakeholders, regular series of teleconferences. So we've been very lucky. But in a way, I think the sense of comfort and calm is in itself a little bit discomforting. As we've become better informed, as we've heard the words of Hamid and Turay, everything seems to be okay. This is not about internet governance. I think I've heard that before. And I can only imagine what would have happened at WSIS if we weren't all there. So from an Australian perspective, we're largely going along. Outer will be on the Australian delegation. APNIC will be there as well. We're largely going along because it's at your peril that you're not at the table. So I think that's just something that I wanted to reiterate, that even if it looks like there's no concerns domestically, I would still encourage CCs to keep their finger on the pulse.
Thank you very much, Paul. Bill, did you have a point to raise?
I just want to make a small point here. One of the strategies that has been pursued by the ITU in sort of downplaying the concerns of the internet community around the wicket has been to say, well, we're not doing internet governance, and so therefore you shouldn't get yourselves all twisted up. And this is a reflection of a longer trajectory, which is that the Secretariat has always tended to equate internet governance only with the management of names and numbers and the what we call critical internet resources in IGF land. And we had this experience even in the working group in internet governance in 2005, 2004, when we first met to try to define internet governance and write a report for the UN that would help break the deadlock in WSIS on all these issues. The Secretary General of the ITU came in and started us off with a little speech telling us that we should only talk about names and numbers and that we shouldn't think about anything else. And we all said thank you very much, and then we then proceeded to develop a definition and an approach to internet governance that took into account all forms of global frameworks, public, private, multi-stakeholder, and so on, pertaining to internet's underlying resources and their use for information, communication, and commerce. This broad understanding of internet governance has been nominally the agreed understanding of the everybody involved in the Internet Governance Forum and so on going forward. And yet the ITU keeps referring only to names and numbers as Internet Governance and saying, since we're not talking about ICANN's issues, we're not touching on Internet Governance. To me, if there's a multilateral regulatory treaty that impacts the Internet, routing, security, fraud, whatever else, that is internet governance. That is specifying rules that shape how the internet is configured and used. I'm sorry. So the notion that there's no linkage here, I think, is a political stratagem, but it's not a very accurate description of reality.
Point well made. Thanks, Bill. Young M, and then Nick.
Okay. I just wanted to add that the TTA person that was following WCCT actually believed the statement that WCCT was not involved with internet governance, and he would say, oh, this is not about internet governance. It was, no, it is about internet governance. So we had to kind of educate them.
Okay. Thank you. And I think a final point from Nick.
Keith, thanks. Nick Thorne, I've been very interested in this exchange, and I think my first comment would be well done. Since the last time we discussed this in Prague, I think some real progress has been made, particularly in getting people who understand the internet onto the delegations who will be in the room in Dubai. I was sparked to ask for the telephone by Paul's reference to WSIS, where I played a role in 2005. And I think my addition to this discussion would be just to emphasize that at WSIS, there was a long preparatory process in which diplomats and politicians participated. In WCCT, we will be dealing with a group of representatives from member states. And in parenthesis, it's wrong to demonize the ITU. That's just the vehicle or the forum. The ITU is the sum of its member states. But the folks who will be around that table, some of them have got rather different agendas from you. And many of those agendas are driven by a deep feeling of resentment which emanated from WSIS, where certain countries feel that they have felt and still feel that they were bounced into a multi-stakeholder process which allowed folk like you and civil society to have a say in how the internet was run. There are a number of countries out there who don't like that and who have regretted it ever since WSIS. They will be in the room. This will be a UN conference, and what happens at UN conferences, and I'm sorry, I've done lots, is that at the end of week one, you will get a chairman's proposal, which will be a compromise to cut through the crap, if you'll excuse my bad language, and bring things down to a manageable set of proposals. There will then be a long argument over the weekend in the middle, about that. There will almost certainly be no agreement, because a few countries will be standing up solidly and saying no. There will then be a second chairman's compromise. Both of these compromises, those of us who know the system, will recognise will have been written by the same guy sitting inside ITU. At least that's how some speculate. But my point is that there will be new proposals on the table in the room, and if you are not represented in that room, those who are representing you will probably not understand the impact of those proposals on the issues which are of real concern to you. So steady as you go. The more of you, the better on your own delegations. Thanks.
Thank you, Nick. And I think your call to action when you're on our panel in Prague, we can say, has been well and truly answered. And certainly the CCTLD world has become very aware of the issues, so if not engaged, are at least aware. And I think in that regard, our job here is done. It's been really refreshing to hear that significant African participation is coming and so on. So I think the response, the call to arms has been forthcoming, and I think probably most importantly it's to remember that this is not something that finishes on the 14th of December. It's actually probably a three-year process. So I think we need to gird our loins and go forth for two or three years on this matter. Anyway, our time is up. In fact, we're over time a bit. Apologies, Chair. Please join me in thanking the panel for their excellent presentations. Thank you all.
Okay, thank you very much, Keith. Next up, we have another visitation from the GNSO. Which is very good of you to come back. We obviously didn't scare you enough last time. This is Michele, who many of you will know already, come to talk with us about the locking of a domain name subject to UDRP proceedings. Okay, so the quicker we settle, the quicker we can get to coffee. Okay, so welcome, Michele, and over to you.
Thanks, Leslie. Good morning, everybody. Michele from Black Knight. I'm the chair, one of the chairs of the GNSO working group on UDRP lock. For those of you who aren't familiar with UDRP, it's the dispute resolution policy that is used with all GTLDs, and I realize that several of the CCTLDs use it or a version of it, whereas others of you probably have your own dispute resolution policies. For example, I know Nominet has their own. The reason that I'm here talking to you, is, apart from the fact that I love hanging out with the CCNSO, since you're always so polite and friendly, apart from Roloff, obviously, is because we were hoping to get your input and assistance, since we know that many of you have already dealt with this, with the issue. And one of the things that several of us feel is that, you know, CCs, you've been around for a very long time, you've got very well-developed policies, you've got procedures that work, whereas in the GTLD space, sometimes these things become overly complicated and not that functional. There were discussions in the GNSO about a wider review of the UDRP in its totality. However, that's been punted until after new TLDs go live. However, we were able to get the GNSO to give us the opportunity to review a particular aspect of the UDRP, which is one to do with the actual procedure and process. It's basically down to the locking, the freezing of the domain names, and when that happens during a dispute. At the moment, the UDRP makes references to maintaining status quos. It makes references to when this happens, but it's not that clear. And what we've been trying to do is to work out exactly at what point within the process, you know, when should the lock happen, how quickly should it happen, when should these locks on the domain be removed, what constitutes a lock, because that itself isn't really clear. And so what we've been trying to do is trying to get input from people within the GNSO, the CCNSO, and, you know, the wider community, just to help us with this. So to date, Marika, of course, has been helping us with this, as always. You'll have to excuse me. I was at the ARI event last night, so I'm a bit frazzled, as usual. I know, Leslie, it's terrible. So that's basically where we're at. We're just trying to get some input from people. So if there's any of you who have experiences with dealing with UDRPs or other dispute mechanisms, and how do you actually handle that? I mean, when do you lock the domain names down? Or do you lock the domain names down? I mean, I don't know what you all do within the CCs. So we're just looking for any input, any assistance, any help, or you can just tell us that we're all crazy. That's perfectly okay, too.
Well, we know most of you are crazy. Okay, so what experiences do we have to share, either on your UDRP or your UDRP predecessor or successor or equivalent, regarding locks? Debbie.
DebbieMonaghan.nz. Well, we're in control of our own system, so it's going to be much easier than it's going to be under the UDRP. Essentially, as soon as a complaint comes in and it's deemed valid, the registry undertake the lock for us, and it stays locked until the end of the process, basically. The parties either come to an agreement, they negotiate their way out, the expert determines, makes a determination, or the complainant drops the complaint. So basically, from go to woe, it's locked and no change can be made to the record. It doesn't change the DNS, of course, and there's no change. So the name continues to resolve. It's just purely that the record can't change.
So just if you don't mind me just following through on that, when you say lock, I mean, what do you allow any changes to the domain name of any kind, or is it, if can they change the name servers, can they change registrar, is it completely frozen?
It's completely frozen. It can be renewed, but no, there's no change to any record. If they have a major issue, for example, we have had a case where the DNS provider fell over, so we actually with the registry's help, to actually process the change of the name server. But no, normally it's just totally locked down, no change to the record at all.
Thanks.
Hi, Michele. Mike from CIRA. Just to let you know, again, we have the our own version of the UDRP, but essentially we do, once a complaint is officially in the process, it is locked in the sense that they're not allowed to delete it or transfer it to another person, but I believe they would be able to potentially allow it to transfer it to another registrar.
Just following on that, how do you decide when the process has actually started? Because this is one of the problems we're facing.
We have two official dispute resolution providers, and once they notify us that they've received a complaint and all the check boxes have been ticked off, that's when we alter the records in the registry.
Thanks.
Sabine?
Hi, Michaela. Sabine from .de. We do a lock only. We have not a dispute resolution in place, but we usually refer the people to the courts. But what we offer is if somebody can prove rights, potential rights, to a domain, we lock the domain, and then the complaint can go to court and actually resolve the problems with the court or with the actual domain holder. And we lock only the change of ownership. So the domain can be transferred to another provider, to another registrar. It can be changed, the administrative conduct. It can be changed, the technical context. It can be changed, the name service. But it cannot change the holder of the domain, because that actually is, from our perspective, the one in charge for the domain. Until the complaint is either resolved, it's deleted by the domain holder itself, or it is actually, we received a court order, and we limited that currently to 1 year. And if it should be extended more than 1 year, then we actually, the complainant has to provide us with documentation that he has actually a running court claim or something like that.
Sabine, just following up on that, what would happen, say, if the domain was about to be deleted or expired, or expire when this kind of thing was kicked off?
We don't have an expiry of a domain, as we have a sort of a permanent contract. So it can only be actively deleted by the, actively cancelled by the domain holder, and then actually we offer it to the complainant. So he can actually get the domain because we don't care anymore.
Okay, thank you, Sabine. Roloff?
Roloff Meijer from srdn.nl. Yes, we have a lock on domains as well. And one of the situations in which we do it is if we have a complaint that is handled by WIPO, we have something like a URDP, but our own version. It's run by WIPO. As soon as we get notified by WIPO, a lock on the domain will be implemented. It means it cannot be cancelled, it cannot be transferred to another registrant, but in most cases it can be transferred to another registrar. And the lock will be there until the procedure will be completed.
Yep, thank you.
We had Andres right at the back, and then Annabeth.
Okay. Andre Philippe de Cizzi. We use the Czech arbitration court. That's also UDRP provider. So if there is a dispute, and we are informed usually online from Czech arbitration court, or we will get a paper from a state court. We usually lock the domain, so it cannot be the administrative and owner contact cannot be changed, and the domain cannot expire. And this lock is for about 4 months. So if we will not get any information in 4 months, we just release the lock. And in the lock, you can change the owner to the suing party, so that's possible. And if this can be done just once a year, so if it's another case, you need to get a court order to make this, you know, to avoid too many lockings of the domain. So that's how we deal with that.
Thanks.
Okay, Annabeth and then Liz.
Hello, Annabeth Lange from .no. We have our own dispute resolution body based on the UDRP, so it's about the same rules, but we handle it ourselves. And when a complaint comes to our registry, we block the domain name at once, and it will be blocked all the way through until the decision is implemented. And if it's deleted, sometimes we experience that they try to delete it while the process is going on, and then it's still blocked for a while until the decision is taken. And you cannot transfer it to another registrar either.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Lisa Foot from .dk. Well, we are a regulated CCTLD, and we have a complaint board that's defined in our law that takes care of complaints. Whenever a complaint is received to the board, they tell us, and we'll lock the domain. But the DK domain is a sole registry, so you can't do any transferring, you can't do anything. We'll lock it. The only thing you can change is the address of the registrant. So.
Thanks. Seems like you all have a slightly simpler process, which is wonderful for you.
Simpler is normally better, yeah. Okay, anyone else? Marika?
Here we go. So hi, this is Marika. I'm the policy person supporting this working group. Maybe another question as well, because some of you spoke about that you lock the domain when you're notified by the dispute resolution provider or when you receive a complaint, because one of the issues that the working group, I think, is struggling with as well, that there have been many instances, depending on when you lock, that there might be cyber flight. So if you wait for the official notification from the UDRP dispute resolution provider, the domain name is already transferred out somewhere else because they have been notified through their registrar because the complaint was already received. Is this an issue that you also see in your communities, or that's not an issue at all? And if so, how have you dealt with that, or are you dealing with that?
Sabine?
Yes. As we are directly with the complainant, actually, usually we recommend the one who have a problem with the domain name to first contact us, then set the lock, and then contact the domain holder. So that's actually not an issue.
Just to clarify, I suppose, something. Do you all have a contractual relationship with the registrant?
Yes. Or I think most of us.
Are there any of you who do not have a contractual relationship with the registrant? I see a hand back there.
That's Debbie from .nz. She'll have found another way.
Well, I suppose we do have some sort of contractual relationship, but not a direct one. The registrant signs up with the registrar, but as part of the terms and conditions, we control what the terms and conditions have to be in the registrar's agreement that the registrant signs, and they get bound to our policies through that particular agreement, which means we can enforce it. And so the clause says that they're bound to the DNC policies, which may change from time to time. And so basically they're all bound through that third party loop.
Hello, I'm Kirsi Sunila-Putilin from the Finnish Communications Regulator Authority, and we are actually running .fi. So since we are an authority, all the decisions, also the granting of the domain name, they are administrative decisions. That's why we don't have a contract with the registrant. But we are also following the same kinds of rules that have been already explained here. And just to comment on your question about what happens if the domain name expires while there is a lock, usually in our case, the whole case ceases to exist. So we will just inform the person or the organization that started the process that it's no longer pending, because we have also a special feature for .fi that we have in-house dispute resolution. Okay.
Thanks.
I think you've got plenty to be going on with, and also we've demonstrated that one size doesn't fit all once again. But clearly a lot of experience and case studies, I'm sure, to share with you. If you'd like to do follow-ups with any particular CCs, do let us know and we'll arrange that.
Thanks, Leslie, and thanks to all of you for sharing your experiences. And if any of you are willing to, you know, share more experiences with us or help us and advise us, we would look to you, because I think, you know, you do have a lot of experience.
Okay, so if you'd like to send an email to the Secretariat, we can put it on the list. Particularly if you're focused on the questions you're asking, that would be incredibly helpful. And we can probably be a bit more informative in our responses.
Thank you, Leslie.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We're going to break for coffee now, and we are back here at 11 o'clock, please.